Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice-weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I'm Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. Today, we're going to do a mailbag-centric episode. Usually, we do a lot of kind of game talk and then kind of one or two big focal points of the show. Today, I think we just felt like it might be best to, you know, usually we only have time to get to three or four mailbag questions, and usually we do for that reason kind of tend to skew toward things that we can answer relatively quickly. And today we just wanted to give you guys the opportunity to ask some of your big picture questions or interests, and we can spend a little more time on them dedicated to kind of the topics you guys want that maybe we don't always get to. So anyway, that's what we're going to do today. The Red Wings did play last night at Columbus. They lose 4-1. Columbus just sniped Jonathan Bernier four times. Anthony Mantha scored. Anything else notable?
No, I think that was basically it. I think the Red Wings, the highlights for the Red Wings basically ended after the Mantha power play goal. And so, yeah, that's pretty much it from my standpoint.
All right. So let's just get into the mailbag then. I mean, I think as we were doing show prep, you kind of pointed out that most of the questions seem to fall into two or three different categories. And the first one of those that obviously was coming up is kind of a status report, I guess, on the rebuild. And so there's a few different ways of framing it. I have a personal favorite that I think we'll get to in a few minutes here. But, you know, let's just kind of dive in on the status of the rebuild. I mean, I think I kind of tend to draw the timeline of the Red Wings rebuild to starting in 2018. And I don't know if that's a huge personal bias, because that is literally exactly when I started covering them, was the trade deadline of 2017-18. But I also look at it and I see that's when they traded off a guy like Tomas Tatar. It's when they traded off Peter Mrazek. You know, they had already picked in the top 10 the year before, but I think that's when you really started seeing almost every move they made look like the move of a rebuilding team. And so I guess before we dive into some of these questions specifically, is that, just so we have a clear frame of reference, is that what we're talking about here? It started in 2018?
Yeah, I think the 17-18 season is probably the best spot where you can really say that the Red Wings kind of started. And really the trade deadline, I think, makes a lot of sense, because, you know, that is where they make the most moves in terms of guys that they ship out and deal. And then, you know, ultimately at the end of the season, Henrik Zetterberg retires. And so now you can really see, like, okay, we're full on shifting into this rebuild. And now the organization has bought into it and they are actively trying to do this.
Yeah. Okay. So with that said, the question that I'll kick it off with is from Fake Philip Zadina. He asks, people said this year be better than last, and it has, but not by much. I'm wondering if the lack of results this year, do the lack of results this year affect your view on the timeline of the Red Wings becoming a playoff contender?
I mean, this is such an interesting question, because I think, you know, you and I probably at the beginning of the season said that we didn't think the Wings were going to be much more than a bottom five team again.
I think our point projections, you know, were like, you know, low 40s or something. I think mine was 47, so maybe high 40s for me. I'm going to be way wrong.
Yeah, and I think I had 45 or something like that. So, you know, either way, not really in that strong of a spot. But, you know, even to both of our point projections, I believe the Red Wings have actually underperformed relative to what you and I projected there. I mean, they're coming in with a 340 points percentage, which, while better than the 275 points percentage they had last year, is still very, very bad. And so, you know, you have to ask yourself, does this impact what the timeline looks like? I think for me personally, it doesn't, because I was always thinking 4+ years before you're seeing anything meaningful. And I think it's the same here. Again, the lack of results is consistent, although it's a little bit worse than what you and I thought it would be, but it still doesn't change for me the fact that they're at least 4 years away from being a legitimate contender. And I think that timeline still holds up.
I partly agree, and I partly disagree. I have seen my timeline for the Red Wings contention feel like it's slipping backward in my kind of mental conception. It has nothing to do with the team's performance. The team is exactly what I thought they would be. But I think the fact that the players who I think the Red Wings most need to be the ones who are doing what little scoring they do and are making these, you know, most pronounced impacts haven't been. And that is what ultimately affects things. I'm not really talking about Dylan Larkin here, because I think while Larkin's not scoring as much, I think he's still playing more or less how you expect and need him to play. He's actually been a little better defensively this year. Puck's not going in for him. You know, that certainly is affecting the point totals, and the power play is affecting that as well. It's not so much about Dylan Larkin, but with Anthony Mantha and Filip Zadina, those are the two guys that when you look at Dom Lucic's cup checklist, or contender checklist, I guess, most teams that are a top five or six team in the league, that are a real contender, have a certain number of wingers who meet a certain GSVA threshold. And Mantha was kind of comfortably in that tier entering this year, and Zadina was a guy who looked like he wasn't quite in that tier, but he was moving up toward being, you know, a kind of capable top six, probably second line on a contender winger. Well, now here we are, and Mantha has taken what seems like a step backward, or at the very least, if he's not a step backward in terms of his ability, it's just a step backward in terms of his production. And visibly, you know, it hasn't looked like the same player. And while I'm certainly not punting on, you know, expectations for Filip Zadina being a top six player, it has taken a longer time for him to be that impact maker impact maker. And I kind of was expecting about a half point per game season from him this year, which I think if he did it over a full season would have been a step forward for him, even though that was about the rate he was at last year. But he hasn't done that. And I do think he's a bit snake bit. He's shooting 3%. That's not going to keep up. But it does make me a little less bullish on him reaching that threshold that for that cup checklist, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years when I expected them to really turn the corner. I think I had 2022-23 as my turn the corner season, and now you're on that playoff bubble. I don't think that anymore.
Yeah, I think that's fair because, you know, again, how much or how quickly the Wings are able to speed this up is all about, you know, I think we've said this on the show a number of times, how much those guys outperform their projections and outperform kind of their draft slot. And that's what really gets you going in the right direction. You know, I think a couple years back when Filip Hronek jumped on the scene and he showed that he could maybe be a capable defenseman, a lot of people were really excited about that. I think he's certainly taken some step backs in the last 2 years. I think Filip Zadina, and then, you know, having him fall to you at six in that draft when a lot of people had him going top three was really exciting. And you're kind of hoping that he's able to do it. I think it's real important. You know, like you said, Max, you're not writing him off. He's still 21 years old, but six points in 18 games, only one goal, shooting 3%. Not necessarily the point totals you'd like to see. I think maybe one encouraging piece of information, if you're looking for it with Zadina, is that, you know, from an on-ice impact standpoint, he does seem to grade out quite well in terms of kind of the best season of his career. You know, when he's on the ice at even strength, the Wings are doing better things. The Wings actually have a, you know, greater than 50% goals for percentage with him on the ice at 5-on-5. You know, that's effectively a clever way of me saying plus minus, so just ignore that. But in reality, the Wings are scoring more with him on the ice. It's not necessarily that they're driving play, so that may or may not hold up. But for now, you know, you have to be encouraged. And if you're looking kind of at his goals above replacements per 60 minutes for guys who kind of play the amount of time he's played, he's kind of sitting right in between John Tavares and actually Andrei Svechnikov, which is interesting because Svechnikov's having a little bit of a down year. But that's where he's sitting right now. And so, you know, maybe you take a little bit of encouragement that the point totals aren't there, but the on-ice impacts are. You know, he did miss a stretch of time being on the COVID protocol. So that's maybe why I'm still going to maintain cautious optimism. But in reality, I think you and I are saying the same thing in that I've just been 4+ years, whether it's 7 or 5 is the same to me. But maybe in your eyes, maybe you're sliding back a little bit more from there.
Yeah, you know, and that's a good point. And I definitely want to reiterate, I still think Filip Zadina is a top six winger. Like, I don't think the Red Wings missed on that pick. It's just in terms of when it happens for him. Like, I was expecting him to basically be, you know, very much an established, like, any team in the league by now is probably having him in their top six. And I just don't think that would be the case on a lot of teams in the league right now. I still think he gets there. It's just clearly going to take longer. And that's okay. Like, you look at guys, was Anthony Mantha even in the NHL at this age?
No, I mean, Mantha was not consistently in the NHL at this age. And that's, again, because he had some of the injury issues. He broke his leg. He ended up missing some time. But no, Mantha didn't really break full time in the NHL at that point.
Yeah. So for those reasons, like, I think it's really easy to, as like a hockey public, to you see some of these teenagers come in and they just wreck the league. McDavid, Matthews, Pettersson, I think, was 20. You know, and you think, okay, well, if you're going to be a good player at 20, you're going to be a, you know, this. But, you know, that can be true for elite players. But there's a lot of good players, and even some really good players who it does take 3-4 years for. And one of the key kind of things to me is that, like you mentioned, if he's making a positive impact without scoring, that's one of those things that is encouraging for the Red Wings, because that allows you to let him play through it. Like, you don't have to send him down, and you don't have to worry about all this stuff. He's not hurting your team when he's not scoring. You still want him to score. You drafted him to score. But you can let him play through it because he's not hurting you when he's not scoring.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And honestly, you know, when I was mentioning his goals above replacement numbers, they actually look worse than they should be because of how bad the power play's been.
And he's been good on the power play.
Right. He's been good, but because the power play hasn't scored, and that's the target variable for the evolving hockey model for goals above replacement, that's a big negative for him. In fact, he loses minus 0.5 goals above replacement per 60 minutes there, which is a sizable chunk. And so if you're able to swing that back towards a positive like he has been the past 2 years, I think you're actually talking about a relatively decent season from an on-ice impact standpoint. I know people want to see the point totals. I think it'll come. You know, he is 21. It's going to take a little bit of time. He's playing on a team that's just been decimated by injuries. I mean, he's struggling to find consistent line mates. That's going to be a challenge for anybody. And really, this is still, he's still not even hit. You know, I think he just passed 50 games in the NHL. So I think he will get there with time, but he hasn't even hit a full season's worth of games yet.
Yeah. All right. So let's go back to the macro then. And a couple questions that are kind of team comparison style. The first one is from Mike Lennox, and he says, do you worry about the lack of game-breaking talent in the Red Wings system forcing them to become a New York Islanders type of rebuild?
I mean, the New York Islanders have game-breaking talent. They have Matt Barzal. They have Anthony Beauvillier. They have guys that can really do it. But I think people give them that rap because of how they're coached. I mean, that's Barry Trotz's style is suffocating. I mean, I don't think anyone would have said the Washington Capitals were you know, lacking game-breaking talent with Ovechkin and Backstrom when they won the Cup under Barry Trotz, but the style they play is suffocating. But, you know, ultimately, I get the point of the question, and I get what they're getting at in that, are you going to be the suffocating defensive team that is basically maybe the Minnesota Wild's more of an apt comparison as opposed to the Islanders? And to me, I'm not worried about it because I think some of that's just coaching influence more than anything else. I think, you know, coaches can always bring in different kinds of ideas, philosophies, things along those lines. I think we've seen that Blashill is a defensive-minded coach that has done a good job with neutral zone defense, but maybe not so much from an offensive zone standpoint. But, you know, sure, there's maybe not game breakers on the team right now. I think Larkin's got the speed. Mantha's got the talent when he's able to put the game there. But there may be some coming. I mean, like we said, Philip Zadina is still developing, you know, Moritz Seider looks like he could be a game breaking talent from the defensive end, at least. And then Lucas Raymond's a human highlight reel, and Jonathan Bergeron's also a human highlight reel. So I'm not necessarily worried about it because I think what you see in that regard is mostly a coaching influence more so than a player influence.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm going to take you down weird street for a minute here, but there was some comments on one of my stories recently, and couple of fans were going back and forth. Just so you know, I read all of your guys' comments, almost all. Sometimes you post them too late and I don't go back and look, but I read a lot of your guys' comments on the stories. And two fans were going back and forth a little bit about the style of the Red Wings. And someone basically was kind of, I think I'm going to misquote them, but it was about like, do you want to be like the 90s Devils or do you want to be like the 90s Red Wings? And I almost wonder, like, is there a faction of this fan base that doesn't just want to win? They want to win like how they remember winning, in the style of the Russian Five and Yzerman and Shanahan and all these just fucking studs. And it's not enough to win. You got to win and be the most watchable team in the league. You, I think, could have a good temperature for that. How do you feel about that? And am I just extrapolating one interaction and making it a narrative?
No, I think that's a fascinating angle for this, right? Because, you know, if you look at a lot of the different cup winners over the years, there are very different teams that are able to pull it together and win the Stanley Cup. I mean, the 90s was fascinating because, I mean, for those who are able to be old enough and remembered our the 94-95 finals where the Red Wings rolled in and played a New Jersey Devils team that was barely above 500, barely made the playoffs, really only got there, you know, because it was a shortened season and they were able to just squeak in. And then that team just comes through and sweeps the Wings. And you go, huh, that's different. That's certainly something I wasn't expecting. And the Red Wings really took a huge shock to that. And then more recently, if we look at Stanley Cup champions, they have been the really dominant offensive teams. It's been the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's been the Washington Capitals.
Chicago.
It's been Chicago. It's been Pittsburgh. But there have been the mix of the other teams, which is St. Louis, which is the Kings. You know, those teams that are maybe that heavier hockey, suffocating defense, winning on the strength of their goaltending plus back end, while still being able to be aggressive offensively, not quite the level of the Devils, you know, from the 90s. But even then, you have to remember those 90s Devils teams were still supremely talented. I mean, they had a number of high-quality scorers on there. I mean, you had your Jamie Langenbrunners, you had your Scott Gomez was quite a player back then. I mean, Patrick Elias, I don't think, had played as much on those teams, but he was still a, you know, a heck of a hockey player. You had Jason Arnott. You had, you know, I could go on and on and on about all those Devils teams. They had a lot of talent. And then even on the back end with Scott Niedermeyer, Brian Rafalski, Scott Stevens, I mean, that was a heck of a hockey team that could play that. To my standpoint, I mean, you can win in a lot of different ways in the NHL. I think you've seen that over the years. You saw what Columbus did to Tampa Bay the year prior. I
mean, yes.
Right? They sweep Tampa. Tampa is a supremely offensive, talented team, and they get swept. But Columbus is able to come in and exert their style. So to quote the great and late Al Davis, just win, baby. I don't really care how it happens. But I can see how Red Wings fans who have been spoiled with the flash and the flair of Datsyuk and Zetterberg and Fedorov, Yzerman, Shanahan, the Russian Five. I mean, you're spoiled for 30 years. I can see how you want to win that way. And that also, in my opinion, seems to be the most obvious way to win, right? These supremely skilled players. But I do think there are other ways to win. And at the end of the day, I don't really care. I just want you to win hockey games.
I can't find the exchange. I wish I could find it because, you know, it wasn't like super deep and meaningful or anything like that. But it just, you know, like I can't remember exactly what it was. So I apologize to those who were the ones having it. If you are one of the people that I'm talking about, or you were part of this exchange or saw this exchange, shoot me a DM and I would love to get like a little extrapolation on your thoughts because I am interested in this. I want to say really quick, you brought up the Lightning and one thing that I adore about the Lightning and one reason that I will pick them to win the Stanley Cup until they give me a reason not to, is because they're all of those things. Like, yes, they are a super offensively skilled team. They have Braden Point. They have Steven Stamkos. They have Nikita Kucherov. They also have who I think is the best defenseman in the world in Victor Hedman. They also have who I think is the best goalie in the world in Andrei Vasilevsky. They also have a couple of guys in Ryan McDonagh and Eric Chernak and even Mikhail Sergachev who can play for any kind of team. They are just unreal everywhere. Like they have everything. And that's why that upset by Columbus was so stunning is you look at it and you go like, you know, who's ever going to beat these guys? It's not like they're just like some, you know, cute skill team. They can crush you. They can smother you at center ice. They can withstand 60 shots on goal because they have the best goalie in the world. They can do it any way. And that's what I marvel at about that team is like, any kind of game you want to put them in, if you're an opposing coach, how do you game plan for them? You want to put them in a certain kind of game, they're better than you at that too.
Yeah, I mean, what Tampa had happened to them is honestly something that happened to the Red Wings a lot in the 90s and 2000s because, you know, as much as they did win, they didn't win every year. I mean, and in fact, that Columbus series brought back memories for me of 2002, 2003, where the Red Wings were, again, a juggernaut. They were the 2 seed in the West. I mean, if you looked at their top 8 scorers on their team, it was Fedorov, Hull, Shanahan, Lidstrom, Datsyuk, right. Zetterberg, Larionov, and Holmstrom. And then, oh, by the way, you also had Luke Robitaille. You had Steve Yzerman, who didn't get to play that many games.
Rookie Datsyuk.
Right. I mean, and that team gets swept in the first round by Anaheim. And that's an Anaheim Ducks team that had very little. I mean, they had Paul Kariya.
Jagr was good though, right?
That was the J.S. Jagr year. And so it's just, to me, it goes to show you that you can win in a lot of different ways. J.S. Jagr took that team all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals in Game 7 against the Devils. And he sure enough almost pulled it off. They gave him a Conn Smythe trophy to thank him. But I mean, you can win hockey games in a lot of different ways. I think it is evolving to a philosophy where these more skilled teams are starting to win out more than those suffocating teams. You don't have some of the advantages you had of those kind of late 90s, early 2000 teams, such as no two-line pass, and things along those lines. You have fewer power play opportunities called. Power play opportunities are starting to go back up. So I do think it is starting to bias itself more towards teams that have higher end skill, but you still do have teams like St. Louis break through. And so at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter how you win. You just got to win, and you can do it in a lot of different ways.
I don't want to sell anybody hope, but I do just want to point out that as Yzerman's rebuild has gotten underway, I just want to highlight a few different players who I think fit this profile of guys who can win in multiple ways for you. And I think Moritz Seider being the most obvious. You know, when they drafted him, everyone's question is, okay, you got like this defensive stalwart. I don't even know if at the time they drafted him, everyone knew that he also crushed people and was also a steamroller. But so you have that. And then as he evolves, you see, oh, and he's on track to match or break the record for scoring by an SHL U20 defenseman. That's interesting. Moritz Seider can help you in multiple ways, right? He can play multiple kinds of game. Lucas Raymond, when they drafted him, you're in love with his skill, you're in love with his sense. Well, what I quickly found out as I reported around about him in the months after is that, oh, they also really like his compete, and that he's a mad dog. He really wants to be better. He always wants to win. And I think in the World Juniors, I saw a more complete game than I really honestly expected to out of Lucas Raymond. Dylan Larkin fits that. They just slapped the C on his chest, right? There's other guys who I think fit this mold that, Robert Mastrosimoni is not going to reach this like really high, I don't think like, you know, top six tier or anything like that. But this is a guy that if you add him to your bottom six or something, you know, he's known as a real competitor. And guess what? He's got some skill and he's got a good shot. He can give you offense and he's a dog. And I should clarify, because in scouting senses, a dog means somebody who like is dogging it. And I mean it in like D-A-W-G, like, you know, this is a guy I want on my team. Like, I want him because he's going to battle. And if I'm playing with my dog doesn't give up when I'm playing keep away. Like, my dog's on me until she gets the ball, right? Like, that's how it goes. So that's how I mean that. Like, Robert, you know, a puck hound, like, that's the way I'll put it. And then, so Mastrosimoni fits that tier in a different way than somebody like a Lucas Raymond does. But you're getting more and more of these guys. You're not drafting, you know, 10 of the same player every year, but you get enough of them in there and enough of them hit, because not every prospect's going to hit, and all of a sudden you start to look like a team that maybe can play any kind of game that your opponent wants to throw at you too. And so I don't want to sell hope that the Red Wings are going to be like that. You can never really guarantee yourself to be like that. You know, the way Tampa is, you have to stumbled upon Braden Point and Anthony Cirelli in the third round and Nikita Kucherov in the second round. And even then, you might not be where they're at. But I do think some of these guys that they're drafting have the profile that could someday project to be able to win in multiple different ways.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that's the beauty of the draft, and that's the beauty of taking as many getting as many opportunities as possible to make those high picks, particularly in your top three rounds, which is something that, again, in the first couple of years, Yzerman's done an outstanding job of acquiring top three round draft picks to give himself the opportunity to get those kinds of guys that have that compete, that intensity, but also the skill to be able to play in a lot of different ways. So, you know, there may be something to it down the road where the Wings could win in either fashion by suffocating a team defensively and squeaking out a victory, or by just being able to pile on 5, 6, 7 goals.
Yeah. All right. So our next kind of team comparison one is one that it's the Handsome Hockey Podcast sent me a while back and asked me to remember it for a future podcast, and I forgot it, and I'm super glad that he asked it again today, because I think it gets into some really interesting territory, and that is, who would you rather be right now, the Red Wings, the Canucks, or the Sabres?
Man, this is such a fun question, and it's also like...
You sound like you're having fun.
it's so difficult to think through this question, because, so at the end of the day, what's the number one thing you have to have in order to rebuild successfully? The number one thing you have to have is elite talent. Buffalo has it. They have Jack Eichel. Jack Eichel is the best player on any of these three teams.
Yes.
They have that. Vancouver, they have Elias Pettersson, and they have Quinn Hughes, who maybe the jury's out a little early because he's had such a tough start to this season. But he was sensational last year, and I expect him to rebound and find, you know, that tier. And Pettersson is there as well. So Detroit, of the three teams, is the one team that doesn't have that. They could. We'll see how Philip Zadina develops. I don't think he's in that tier. We'll see how Lucas Raymond develops. He may be in that tier, but I don't think that he's there right now. And so if you're Detroit, you're already starting behind the eight ball in the sense of being able to rebuild, because you don't have the most important thing, which is elite talent. However, Detroit does seem to have the most competent front office. They seem to have the best draft capital. They have the most draft picks coming up. They made the most picks in the last year. They have the most salary cap flexibility. So Detroit's kind of in position, from my standpoint, that while they don't have elite talent, they are in position to turn it around quickly they're in the best position to get more because they have so many opportunities to pick. Whereas Buffalo and Vancouver, they don't have as many opportunities. They don't have as many draft picks. They still have most of their own. And then when you're comparing prospect pools, you know, I think Buffalo's got a couple of players. You know, Jack Quinn's in there. Dylan Cousins is going to be great. You know, Rasmus Asplund maybe.
I like Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, Ryan Johnson's a solid player. They have JJ Paterka as well.
Yep.
You know, so that's a solid pool. I'd still take Detroit's ahead of theirs. But Vancouver, you know, Hoglander, he's had a good start to this season. I think
Colson,
legit, and then Pod Colson. But kind of after those guys, I'm not sure that they have, you know, really the same depth or capacity. I mean, so that they might be in the worst position from my standpoint, despite the fact that they have Pettersson and Hughes. They still have a lot of issues with the salary cap moving forward, and they're going to have to pay Pettersson and Hughes this season. So, you know, I might say that if I'm picking out of these, I might pick Detroit, even though they don't have the elite talent. But I do think you wouldn't be wrong to pick Buffalo here.
The other thing Detroit has here is flexibility, and I think that is an important thing to assess in all this too. I mean, there is kind of different ways of looking at this. Who would you rather be a fan of? Who would you rather be the GM of? Who would you rather be the coach of? And who would you rather be a player on? I think you can get different answers to some of those questions. You know, the Red Wings have so much more salary cap flexibility than the Canucks do, and the Canucks are going to have to pay two young stars this offseason. The Red Wings are going to have to pay Philip Hronek and Tyler Bertuzzi, but that's not the same price tag as you're talking about for Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes. You know, the Sabres are in a position where they have Jeff Skinner's contract haunting them right now, and it's like 2 years into it. You know, Jack Eichel's contract is high, but I still think it's a positive value contract by quite a bit, even in the $10 million range. And I don't think they really have anyone they're going to have to overpay. I mean, Dahlin's contract is up this year. I'm curious to see where that lands. But overall, I don't think Buffalo's cap situation is all that bad. If you can get out of Skinner, which you probably can't, and so that sucks. But yeah, I mean, I think there's different things to like about this. I mean, I agree. If I could take one of these players and just steal them, and I'm starting in a, if I'm Seattle and I want to just steal one of these guys, I'm taking Jack Eichel first. Dahlin's not far behind that for me. You know, Pettersson is in that, is in there too. Dahlin, I think I'd still take above Hughes. And all of those guys I'd take above.
Dahlin above Hughes is bold.
I think I would. I think I would. I mean, I still believe it in the overall game of Dahlin coming around. I will grant Quinn has been a better player so far since their draft days.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating whole subset of conversation there. But, I mean, it's tough. This is a really tough question because of that challenge of the fact that the Red Wings of the three teams has probably the lowest talent pool right now, but they have all the other pieces that if and when they are blessed with elite talent, whether that is Philip Zadina finding another gear, Lucas Raymond coming over, Moritz Seider coming over, they are in the best position to do something with it. Buffalo is not. They have, you know, like you said, Max, Jeff Skinner's deal runs for years. It's in fact the longest deal on their cap portfolio. You still have Kyle Okposo for two more years at $6 million. That's not pretty. You have Rasmus Ristolainen for another year at 5.4. You know, you've got you just have a lot of pieces that aren't great, but it's still not as bad as Vancouver's situation. And so that's where I think maybe if I'm ranking these, I'm going to go Detroit, Buffalo, Vancouver, just because I think if you took over Buffalo and you found a way to get out of the Skinner deal, you would be in a pretty good spot. But Vancouver just seems like a bit of a mess. I mean, JT Miller, I don't know what's happened to his game. He's owed $5.25 million for another couple years. You know, they've got Antoine Roussel for another $3 million next year, Jay Beagle for $3 million next year. You know, they're already talking about trading Jake Virtanen, who hasn't panned out to be what they thought he would. I mean, Tyler Myers is $6 million for three more years. Nate Schmidt's got $6 million for another 4 years after this year. I mean, Holtby has been terrible, and he's got 4.3 for next year. So you just don't want to be Vancouver, I think. Even though they have probably the second-best prospect pool, second-best talent pool, they probably have the worst cap structure of those three, and I think that's enough for me to put them third right now.
Their stars aren't disgruntled though, and that's a factor too. Like if I'm taking over as GM of Buffalo, you know, as Kevin Adams is, he walks into a situation where midway through his first season, everyone in the league is talking about whether he's going to trade his franchise player, and that is extremely you know, that's a drag on everything. You know, like you're in this good situation, but you might have to blow it up and start again. And oh, by the way, as much as I am shocked that I can say this when comparing anybody to Vancouver, I think Buffalo's got the most impatient fan base in the league right now. Like they are ready for something good to happen there, and they need it to happen yesterday.
I mean, they've suffered for a really long time.
Oh, I sympathize.
Time.
I sympathize.
They've suffered for a decade here. I mean, it really, there were some really good Buffalo teams in the late 2000s, and you know, the team that was with Chris Drury on that team, I mean, that was a heck of a hockey team. And now they've just suffered in purgatory for 10 years. They tried to sell all out, you know, for Connor McDavid. They get a great consolation prize and Jack Eichel. And then they just can't put the pieces around them. And so then they get another first overall pick in Rasmus Dahlin. And they just can't put it together. And now, you know, Dylan Cousins looks like a player. I mean, J.J. Paterka looks like a player. But they take Jack Quinn a little early, and that's a little surprising. I mean, with Marco Rossi and Cole Perfetti on the board, like, well, I'm not sure what was necessarily being thought of there. And, you know, so it's all fascinating to see. But I still think they're in a spot where if the right person came in, could talk to Eichel, you're still going to get Eichel's best years. Eichel's best years should arguably be this year, the next year, and the year after that. And a guy of his talent is probably going to preserve his elite talent until he's probably 32, 33. You still have time to make this work. And you don't have that much to buy your way out of. However, you know, it's still a huge challenge, and Buffalo's fan base is very impatient right now.
I think I'm at Buffalo number one, honestly, but I realize the insanity of saying it. Like, and if they have to trade Jack Eichel, I rescind this and I never said it. But I really like the collection there. I mean, I like Eichel. I like Cousins. I don't know what's going to happen with Mittelstadt, but you look at this and you have the two hardest things to find. They don't have the goalie, but they have Eichel and Dahlin, and the two hardest things to find. So does Vancouver, Pettersson and Hughes. But then I also like, you know, I think Cousins can be a better version of Horvat, right? I think there's some good wing talent there. I don't know what Jack Quinn's going to become. I can't believe they didn't take Perfetti or Rossi. Or Seth Jarvis. Or Seth Jarvis, for that point, who's tearing it up in Carolina. Or Anton Lindell, your guy, who's having a pretty good year in Liga. Or even Yaroslav Oskarov, I guess, at that point. Like, you need that franchise goalie. I know you would have hated that. Then they'd have been last on your list, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They would have been dead last. Especially if you pass up those four guys for Oskarov.
So. That's right. But they're going to get another top pick this year. Let's say they add, you know, an Owen Power or a Simon Edvinson or a Brant Clark or whatever to the back end. And then you've got a really impressive top six. You've got Peterka coming in a couple years. You've got a couple stars on your blue line. I think I'd go Buffalo number one. And I just don't know how to order Detroit and Vancouver, because Vancouver's cap situation is rough. And I don't know what's going to happen there. Like, you know, I can't fathom that they're going to be in that big of a hurt when you have guys like Pettersson and Hughes, and oh, by the way, Besser and Horvat aren't that old either. But they've still got a lot of pieces to add. I do like Putkolzin, and I think he'll help. But I don't know. I might put Detroit in the middle, but that seems crazy just knowing what we know about Pettersson and Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. Like, it's the totally logical thing would be bet on the elite talent, and of which Buffalo has it, Vancouver has it, Detroit doesn't. However, I'm going to be a little, I'm probably going against conventional wisdom here. Max, I actually think you did probably what I would have done if I just did this normally, which is bet on the elite talent. But I bet on variance, where the Wings have the highest capacity to just all of a sudden shake things up the minute something hits. Because if they remind me a little bit of, if you look at Carolina and like, 2016, 2017, and then 17, 18. I mean, that wasn't a very good team at all, but they were in prime position to turn things around. They did have pieces that Detroit doesn't have. They had Slavin already. They had Pesci already. They had Aho already in the system, pieces that Detroit doesn't have, although we don't know what Raymond, Berggren, and Sider are going to be. But as soon as Andrei Svechnikov hit, they could immediately flip the switch in a manner that Buffalo and Vancouver can't. But that being said, Buffalo and Vancouver have those pieces. So I think it's a fascinating question, because I don't know that there's a wrong answer. Maybe taking Vancouver first would be wrong.
Yeah. All right. And then we'll wrap up the rebuild topic with Phil Roberto. He wants us to do an evaluation of the rebuild up to this point. Is it an effective rebuild if the Red Wings are not playing many young players until the recent call-ups of Svechnikov and Rasmussen? Does it make it a real rebuild if you're not playing some young players?
It's still a rebuild.
Yeah, I agree.
Nothing changes. I think, you know, it's more of an indictment of your rebuild if your young players haven't necessarily wrestled those roster positions away. I think, you know, maybe that's a little problematic, but no, at the end of the day, that's not a huge issue in my standpoint.
I don't think so either. I mean, assessing the rebuild to this point, could they have played more young players along the way? It's possible, but I think this is a dynamic that I've observed, is fan bases who have, like prospects just sometimes don't pan out, or they don't hit their ceiling, or they outright bust or whatever. And when you look at markets who slow play their prospects and they don't pan out, then the reason the prospects didn't pan out is because you slow played them. And when you go to markets who rush their prospects and they don't pan out, then the reasons they didn't pan out is because you rushed them. And so an example here might be Edmonton and Jesse Puljujärvi. And like, you know, you get the sense that like If Edmonton had handled Puljujärvi different, could things have been better? Maybe, or maybe like Puljujärvi just was always going to take longer, and like it was going to take him until this late, even though he was a top four pick to be this. And I think in Detroit, you hear a lot of sentiment that like, you know, gosh, like if Svechnikov scores 3 points in his first two games, why wasn't he on this team all year? And I'm not even necessarily disputing that. Like I think there's a case for it. But I just, you know, and Svechnikov's getting pretty late here. But, you know, I don't think that it necessarily means that everything that's happened with Svechnikov for the past 3 years, some of it which was injury related, actually 2 years of it which was injury related, could have been avoided had they called him up after his first season in the AHL. Like, I'm not ready to make that logical leap.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. And this happens everywhere. I mean, you look at every rebuild that's ever happened. This is just the nature of how it tends to go. I like to pick on Carolina because they're an example of a team that's done the rebuild correctly. And if you go back and you look at their 16-17 season, I mean, Ron Hainsey, 35-year-old Ron Hainsey, was playing more minutes than Noah Hanifin, you know, on the back end for that Carolina team. I mean, Ron Hainsey was playing 22 minutes a night for them, which is just wild. I mean, you had Victor Rask playing more minutes than Sebastian Aho and Teuvo Teravainen. So it happens. It's always going to happen. I don't think it's necessarily problematic. You would certainly like to see those guys just so you know what you have. But the fact that they haven't wrestled those positions away, I think, is more of an indictment on what the organization maybe considers them to be in the long run. But even then, I still don't see it as hugely problematic.
A guy that I'm most fascinated with about this is Chalowski, because he's a guy that broke camp with the team, so it's not like he wasn't getting an opportunity. But then I can also really buy the case that he's a guy that if you just let him work stuff out at the NHL level, could it have been different? I can really see both sides of that one. Like, and I'm not trying to be a fence sitter here professionally, but I can see both sides of it. Like I almost, you know, I certainly think early in Chalowski's career, I jumped the gun and was like anointing him a future top four. I might have even written an article saying he was going to be a top pair defenseman in the first 2 months of his career. And that was my bad. Like that was just a irresponsible leap to conclusion. And so maybe partly because of that, I always was kind of like, why don't you just let him work this out up here? And then in the last year, I've maybe been swayed a little bit the other way, which is that, well, he broke camp with the team twice. It's not like he didn't get an opportunity. And so then there's that side of things. So if it sounds like I'm fence sitting, it's because I've held both of these two opinions in the last 2 years at different times. And I think both are kind of credible. I'm at the point now where, you know, I think you might as well, you drafted this guy with a first round pick, and I know Christian Juice is kind of filling the role he would have. You claim Christian Juice off waivers. Why not just let Chalowski do what Christian Juice is doing? But I think a lot of people would rather see Chalowski in place of DeKeyser or in place of Staal. And I can understand why, from the Red Wings perspective, they don't want to sacrifice what they feel like is the identity they want to develop their roster players who are going to be around in favor of just finding minutes for guys that they spent a first-round pick on. Like, I don't think you want to have any kind of sacred prospects here who you sacrifice the vision for just to get him in a good position. I feel the same way about this is a topic we had a couple of years ago when we were talking about, you know, or maybe, yeah, I don't know how long it was ago, which line Zadina should be on. And I didn't think you needed to rush Zadina onto Dylan Larkin's line, because the goal of the lineup that night was not what's going to get Philip Zadina the most points. The goal of the lineup is twofold. It's win the game and develop your players. And Philip Zadina, I think, you know, have the points come yet? No. But playing on the third line, I don't think stunted him. Like, I don't think that's the situation here. And it didn't last that long. He was in the top six fairly quickly. So, I don't know. I'm rambling now. But I just think that there's no one right way to do it. And the dynamic always is a push and pull from player and organization.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the Wings have been through this over the years with a number of guys who were very talented. I mean, you know, a guy that comes to mind is Ryan Spruill. Ryan Spruill was OHL Defenseman of the Year. I mean, very, very talented hockey player. You know, was a second-round pick for Detroit back in 2011. But he just was never able to consistently crack the lineup and ultimately was dealt, 5 years after he was drafted by the Wings because he couldn't really hold up his end on the defensive side of the puck. And, you know, I think it's been a similar frustration for Chalowski, and I think the Wings are trying to let him sort it out. I do think at some point you are going to see him in Detroit because it is a contract year. You probably don't want to just continue extending in this regard without necessarily seeing him at the NHL level versus, you know, maybe being able to showcase him to a certain extent. But yeah, I mean, I think time is certainly running out for him. And that's not why, or that's maybe more so why I'm not like jumping up and down for him to be in the NHL lineup, because at least with the results we've seen, it's not like he hasn't been given an opportunity. He just hasn't performed. He hasn't given you good results. And I know you can make the counterpoint that, well, the veterans aren't really giving you good results either. But, you know, to a certain extent, they're at least playing the style of hockey that Jeff Blashill wants to play, which is this more conservative defensive style that's not going to give you much flair. And so I think it's better to just let Chalowski sort himself out in Grand Rapids, which, to his credit, he has done a very nice job so far at the start of the season.
All right, let's transition into kind of the other topic that we'll go into today. We already covered, there's a lot of questions about Zadina. I think we already covered that in pretty good depth. The other one was about, from Alex Oliver, what are reasonable RFA deals for Hronek? And as we were kind of picking out some questions before the show, you were throwing out some really interesting stuff from what some of the contract projection sites have for this that, let's get into that right now. What are some RFA projections for Filip Hronek, who is up for a new contract this offseason?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, doing my homework on these questions to make sure I sound intelligent on this podcast, and I never do. Take a perusal over to Evolving Hockey and look at their contract projection model, and they have Filip Hronek as 6 years, $6 million as the average annual value. And so that kind of floored me. I actually almost fell out of my seat when I saw that and had to, you know, quickly pick my jaw up off the floor. But then, you know, you step back and you think about their model. Their model is not necessarily indicative of what they should be paid. Their model is indicative of how an NHL team is likely to pay a player. And so the fascinating thing with Filip Hronek is, even though his on-ice results haven't been there, I've talked about that at length, he plays a lot of minutes. He plays he's a top 20 minute eater, and he scores a lot of points. And so those tend to be two of the most important factors that come when you are projecting a contract for a defenseman, or if you're looking at a team signing a defenseman, it tends to be that, exactly that. And so I think it's fascinating, but that contract number would certainly give me pause for sure.
Yeah. So what does Evolving Hockey have down on a bridge deal? 2 or 3 years? What would their projection? Because they do it by year. They tell you what the projection would be based on each length.
Right. So if you went for 2 years, they have an average annual value of $3.1 million, which is quite palatable. And if you go for 3 years, it kicks up to $4.9 million. So, you know, my opinion would be shoot for that 2 year, $3 to $3.5 million deal as a bridge deal if you're going to go the bridge route.
Yeah. And those just seem much more reasonable. And especially because what we've talked about with Hronek, we've obviously gone back and forth a little bit on this show about, you know, his value and his place going forward. I still think he's long-term like a top four guy that you're going to want in the picture, but I'm not ready to pay him like it concretely for that kind of length. If I'm Steve Yzerman, like I really want to see, you know, two more years, 3 more years, let him slot in where something closer to where he's going to slot in once more at Siders in the picture. And then you can decide what you're going to pay him with some term. But I think 2 years is probably 2 year bridge is probably the ideal. 3 years, if you really need to, I think that makes much more sense.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm going to use your favorite term. I want to see what it looks like when he gets dragged up by somebody. And I think once you bring Moritz Seider over, and you can potentially have some flexibility to move some guys around with Seider. You know, I think you and I kicked around maybe John Merrill as being a good partner for him. If you go that route and you maybe get Troy Stetcher to play a little bit with Filip Hronek, allow Stetcher to be the guy that skates a little bit more, pushes the puck up ice, allow Filip Hronek to do a little less skating, save some wear and tear, you know, maybe be a little bit more of the defensive-minded guy. I think he'll get some better results out of that. And then you maybe have a better idea of what you want to pay him. But I think right now, and his role with his workload, I do not want to pay him to be a number one defenseman because he is not a number one defenseman.
I think that's fair. I mean, I don't think you can only pay your number one defenseman. Like, you know, you still want guys and like, you know, Brett Pesce. I'm not saying Philip Hronek is Brett Pesce, but like an example, like Carolina extended their D Young before they quite knew exactly what the impact was going to be. That's how they got really good deals on guys like Pesce. Slavin turns into a number one. Pesce turns into a really solid top four. I can buy Pesce as a top pair caliber defenseman, but he's a second pair guy for them. It's why they're one of the best blue lines in the league. And I'm fine to pay a guy like that, but I just want to know, I want to know concretely how they fit before I pay him. And if I'm Steve Yzerman, while Filip Hronek is unquestionably the Red Wings' number one defenseman on the NHL team right now, it's just not going to be the case long term. I'm not going to pay him like the number one D when he's not going to be my number one D pretty much the second Moritz Seider gets to Detroit. Not the second. He's going to take him a year or two to adjust, but, you know, not too long after Moritz Seider gets to Detroit.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, when you think about Carolina, you know, they did have a good way of extending those young defensemen early. I think in their respect, Slavin, Pesce, and those guys obviously showed a lot more earlier to merit that. I just have a really tough time with Filip Hronek. I think that's abundantly obvious to anyone who listens to this podcast and has to suffer through my tweets on Twitter. I have a difficult time evaluating him because I don't see the tools there. And so that's where I think if you're Yzerman, you know, you get through with your bridge, you get a better sense, you get more data. I mean, that's at the end of the day, what you're looking for is, let me just get more data points on this guy and let me get more data points potentially where I'm not asking him to tread water and keep his head above the water. I have more guys around him, a little bit more talent, and see what it looks like so I know. Now, you run the risk for sure. If he comes out, throws a 55-point season out there where he you know, plays quite well at 5-on-5 and he does it from like a third-pairing role, or I should say third-D role, first a slot on the power play, then yeah, you may be in a little bit of trouble that you lost your gamble. However, I think the gamble here will work out in Detroit's favor because I'm not sure that that's in his repertoire of being a possibility here.
The other thing is, and God, I do not want to start this on another player with, given how this fan base has sometimes reacted to anytime someone's name and the T word gets mentioned, is if you slow play this and go the bridge route, and he puts up the counting stats that will get him paid, but you're still not convinced, you can, at that point, you can find a trade that will get you something different. You can pivot out of it that way. I mean, that's one of those situations that we've talked about on this podcast in the past, of like a good GM makes good decisions with their back up against the wall. Okay, so what do you do if you have a defenseman who is putting up huge minutes, huge points, but you're not sold that they're, you know, of the same kind of overall situation, you know, impact that others in that situation with those stats would be like? You take a breath and you say, okay, that means I can probably get something pretty good. I'm not by any means starting a Filip Hronek trade rumor. When my trade tiers come out, he will be firmly in the staying put tier. But as we talk about what to do if you bridge him and his points really pop, well, at that point you have the choice. If you believe in it, if he pops and you believe in him, you pay him. And if he pops and you're still hesitant, you know, he's going to be a young right-handed D. Survey says those guys have markets.
All right, folks, you heard it here. Max is fielding trade offers for Filip Hronek. So just go ahead, get him in, send him his way.
All right, Danielle, you're going to have to edit that out. I'm not dealing with that. All right, I think that's going to do it for us today. So everybody, thanks for listening. And if we didn't get to your question, I'm sorry. But I thought that was a fun way to really dive into a few of these questions that normally we can only spend 4 or 5 minutes on. And I wanted to give it kind of closer to an hour today. So I really enjoyed it. Thanks for being patient with us. Thanks for dealing. I've gotten a lot of Twitter questions about whether I'm sick right now. The answer is no. I'm just recording in a different place because I'm dog sitting and I'm trying to keep the dog as happy as possible. As you probably have heard throughout this episode, I'm failing at that. But, you know, I'll be back in my normal recording spot for the next episode. And so hopefully my voice sounds a little more normal to everybody. So the Red Wings, their next game is at Carolina. It is Thursday. It is Thursday night, and it is potentially the Svechnikov Bowl. We don't know for sure. Jeff Blashill today was not committing to whether or not he would be putting Evgeny in the lineup. Evgeny did practice with Darren Helm and Luke Glendening. And so that to me is a little bit of a good sign. He was at least practicing like somebody who's going to be in the lineup. So if you're someone who's really hoping to see the Svechnikov Bowl, I think you're probably quite happy to hear that. But we'll see. I mean, it's going to be, as you saw in the first Red Wings Carolina game, Carolina puts a lot of shot volume up, and it can be hard to keep pace. You kind of got to have the recipe that the Red Wings had in their second game of the season, when they just hung around, and then stole one. So that's the recipe. And if you want to watch that, which I'm sure you do if you listen to this show, you may also want to bet that, and you can do that at betmgm.com, promo code WingsPod, which with whatever you place. And hopefully you win some money.